This is episode 677 of the AWS podcast, released on July 22nd, 2024.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AWS podcast. So I'm Lish here with you. Great to have you back. And I'm joined by a very special guest today. I'm joined by Alex Kimber, who is a principal technologist for HPC for Global Financial Services here at AWS. G'day, Alex. How you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad that you're here. Now, we're going to talk a bit about HPC, but not in the way that maybe a lot of folks are used to. So obviously with high-performance computing or HPC workloads, often it's used for weather simulation and computational fluid dynamics and biotech, lots of very interesting use cases. But today we're going to talk about a different use case. We're going to talk about its use in financial services, which is kind of not what people associate it with often, because they're thinking that financial services companies is more about maybe trading and transactions and recording my bank account and making sure it can store all the zeros for all of our bank accounts and that good stuff. But it's a little more complex than that. So we're going to dive pretty deep on this. Now, you may say, well, Simon, I'm not that interested in HPC. I don't do it in my job. It's not really relevant to me. Well, it's relevant in as much as any architectural pattern is useful and interesting because it can inform you about design trade-offs and approaches you take or may take in the future for things you're working on. And one of the things I always love looking at is problems that involve scale, because scale tends to bring its own interesting set of problems that we can demystify. Now, Alex, you've done this for a while. Tell us a little bit about yourself and sort of what you've seen over time in this space.
Absolutely, yes. So, as you mentioned, I'm the principal technologist for HPC and financial services, and that means I work across the industry to help our customers with the migration of these systems into AWS, and once they're there, to help them optimize and prepare those systems for the future. As you mentioned, scale is a big part of the challenge that we work with.
And so let's look at the workload itself. You know, as I mentioned, for a lot of folks, if you're thinking about financial services, you're not necessarily thinking about high-performance computing in the traditional sense of, you know, fluid dynamics and parallel systems. So tell us, what are we trying to solve for here? What's the business problem?
Yeah, absolutely. So much of financial services is really about risk. So being able to effectively model risk is really key for our customers. And whether that's things like credit risk for mortgages, maybe actuarial risk for insurance, or quite often in capital markets, it's things like market risk. Measuring those risks effectively enables them to better price their products, make sure they're baking those risks into the price. Or perhaps adjust or hedge risks according to the changes in the market. So if the market's more volatile, that can put pressure on these systems. And of course, a big part of what our customers have to do within the financial services industry is reporting to regulators. And actually a big part of that regulatory reporting is being able to demonstrate that they have a good handle on the risks that they're undertaking. And these risk models are really complex and rely very heavily on calculating many, many scenarios. You might have heard of things like Monte Carlo simulation. Sort of parameter sweep techniques. And that's really where large-scale HPC comes in.
This approach, to put a very simplistic hat on it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alex, is really trying to take a view of, well, let's try all the possible permutations and see which one's more likely. It's kind of like, instead of just trying one approach, we're testing a variety of approaches to try and land on the answer, or at least a best approximation of the answer.
Well, absolutely. But of course, you can never test every possible scenario. So the way these things work is they rely on historic data or sort of realistic distributions of inputs to try and narrow down to what's realistic. But of course, you're absolutely right. The more scenarios you run, the better idea you have of the entire surface of possible situations.
So this is a case where, if used intelligently, more is better?
Broadly speaking, yeah.
Okay. So then what's different about this approach to maybe what we'd use in weather modeling?
Yeah, so I generally speak about HPC falling into these two broad camps. So you have tightly coupled workloads like computational fluid dynamics or weather modeling, things like measuring the flow of air over a surface. Now, what's important about those workloads is the output of one calculation can impact another. So to give a really simple example, if you're looking at weather, you know, the air pressure in a particular area is going to be quite closely related to and influence the air pressure of an area right next to it. And so for those workloads, AWS has some great services, things like placement groups and Elastic Fabric Adapter, help to ensure that those tasks can communicate with each other very rapidly to enable those calculations to be done really efficiently. Now, financial services is quite different. So typically, the tasks are loosely coupled, which means they can be calculated independently. So we talked about those scenarios earlier. So if you're calculating a scenario where interest rates are 5% and another scenario where they're 6%, those two calculations are entirely independent. And as a result of that, the workloads benefit tremendously from parallelization. And that gets you into horizontal scalability. And that's where AWS has been a real game changer for many of our customers. And we have customers running hundreds of millions of these scenarios across hundreds of thousands of eCPUs every day.
That's interesting. These type of workloads, often called embarrassingly parallel workloads.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things with this as well is that it's very much based upon a prevailing condition. So often these things will run overnight or when markets are closed or in these types of constrained environments. So you're sort of working with a constraint of you want to run as many permutations as logically possible, but also you've got an end time, don't you? Like you've got to get it done before the data is needed.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a few different typical use cases that we see. And I spend most of my time working in capital markets, and there are sort of a few main sort of use cases. So one is pricing, and that's very real time. So if you're trying to figure out the price of a complex derivative, you need to understand the risks that product involves. And so being able to price that really quickly, well, perhaps a trader is literally on the phone, is really important. So for those kind of workloads, we see these kind of very short, spiky bursts of demand. And then there's kind of intraday trading. So as the trading day is going on, you know, market conditions will vary. Perhaps there's some big news event that means volatility spikes. And again, that means traders need much more up-to-date views of their risk. And so they'll be calculating much more frequently during the day. And then the big stuff kicks off overnight. So once the books close at the end of the day, that's when all of the regulatory risk reporting typically kicks in. So you have these big batch workloads. And they'll also do additional calculations to set the traders up well for the next working day. So we see this kind of steady but spiky usage during the day, and then it really kicks off overnight.
So you talked about big. Let's solve for the sort of volume of big. Give us a feeling for these types of systems and how big they are and what dimensions you consider them to be big across.
Well, we typically talk about vCPUs or vCPU hours, and some of our largest customers are running hundreds of thousands, up to around a million vCPUs at their peaks for those overnight batches.
Wow.
But we also have customers running in the tens of thousands range. That's quite common as well.
And that's not small, because if you think about how many vCPUs you have in a machine and then how many machines it takes to get that number of vCPUs and then get all of them working together and to work consistently and reliably, that's a lot of stuff. A lot of iron.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and you start running into some of these situations that perhaps you might not think about in normal situations, but you know, things like IP ranges. Like, have you made your IP ranges big enough to make sure that, you know, depending on the instance mix that you happen to get, and you know, spot is obviously a big part of these workloads, you know, we encourage diversity. So some situations you might end up with a large number of smaller machines. So in that case, you need more IP addresses.
Well, let's talk about the types of machines. You know, what sort of EC2 instances do customers typically reach for in the first instance, as it were? And what might they evolve to over time as well?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So a lot of our customers are in the process of moving into cloud or have done so fairly recently. And so the architectures typically mirror the kind of things they're running on premises. The majority is x86. And the typical sort of number one requirement is a certain amount of memory per vCPU. So typically maybe 4 gigs, maybe 8 gigs. But beyond that, they're quite flexible. What that means is customers can sort of say, I'll take any instance as long as it meets, you know, this architecture and this amount of memory and kind of give me what's cheapest. And as I mentioned, spot is a big part of what customers are looking at to try and make sure the cost of this stuff is manageable. And in terms of the future, yeah, we do have customers looking at ARM quite seriously. So the Graviton range of CPUs, I think at the scale we're talking about, those kind of price performance improvements are really material and are definitely of interest. So that's a sort of emerging area for these customers.
So as customers are moving to the cloud, obviously, firstly, they're trying to understand the concept of spot, which is, I think, a really useful thing, obviously, for these types of platforms in as much as you're getting the compute for the lowest possible cost. And in fact, fun fact, when I was early on in my tenure at Amazon, when the cloud was new and people didn't know what it was, the folks that understood spot the best in my experience were actually banking folks, because they understand markets and arbitrage and supply and demand. And so the minute I told them about spot markets, like, oh yeah, we get that. That makes nothing but sense.
I've got a good eye for a deal.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good way to put it. So spot can help them because with these workloads, one of the things we're thinking about here is they suit restartability, which is one of the big things you need to think about at size. So how are they coordinating with one another? You've got all these nodes. Are they just pulling from a specific repository? Give us a mental model of how to think about this workload as it spins up, runs, and then shuts down again.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, the sort of core requirement here is to be able to calculate scenarios. So some system will generate all of the scenarios that need to be calculated over the course of, say, a batch. Then there's data that goes alongside those. And typically that's things like market data, perhaps some historic market data or prices and the like. There'll be a set of trades that they want to run the scenarios on. And then some static data, things like holiday calendars, which then you know, some derivatives have specific characteristics around things like when holidays are and how you calculate, you know, the payoffs of those products. So all that data kind of comes together, and we can talk about, you know, how that gets architected in the cloud. But then you're left with this problem. You say you've got 100 million tasks to calculate. So what you typically have is some kind of scheduler. Now, on-premises, there'll be some kind of probably a third-party scheduler. Some customers develop their own. But effectively, the role of the scheduler is to orchestrate that 100 million tasks and basically make sure that they all get completed, but also make intelligent decisions about things like prioritization, retries, or sort of fair share of resources. On the other side, you've got orchestration, which is the management of the infrastructure. Now, in the on-premises world, that was pretty much a procurement process. The infrastructure was largely static. So you'd have, say, 1,000, 2,000 instances sitting in your on-prem data center, and that's kind of all you've got. And so in that world, there's a heavy emphasis on the scheduler to make sure all of the most important work gets done first, that if you have time left over, you do the less important work. As customers move to cloud, as I mentioned, there's a lot of customers who will take that infrastructure with them. And lift and shift is a pretty common pattern, at least as an early step of migrating to cloud. But we are seeing some changes there. So that balance between scheduling and orchestration has changed a little bit because you no longer have static resources, right? Mm. You have this enormous multi-tenant, highly flexible cloud architecture. And then the emphasis moves away from scheduling and towards orchestration. So it's less about fettling the priorities of individual tasks in real time. And it's more about, if I have pending workload, how can I scale up my infrastructure accordingly?
Yeah, you're moving away from a traditional bin packing problem to a getting the job done problem.
Exactly, yeah. And so I think, you know, customers are realizing that actually the scheduler can be a little bit simpler. And so we've started seeing some more straightforward scheduling architectures coming through because AWS can take the heavy lifting of making sure the right infrastructure gets delivered at the right time at the right price.
And we'll dive more into that in a moment, but I want to come back to, you touched on infrastructure and some of the differences. And one of the things that often comes up in a more dynamic workload type is obviously instance startup time. What have you seen in terms of what folks can do to make the instances run quicker? Because obviously the time it takes to fire up the fleet is important to the overall workload.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things that, again, if you're running a small system, you probably perhaps don't give a second thought to. But when you're running at this kind of scale and when you're initializing, say, thousands of instances every day, an instance that takes 30 minutes, 40 minutes to initialize actually starts to become a really material cost because you're paying that initialization time every time for every instance. And so one of the early optimizations we have with customers is how we can bring that instance initialization time down. And often the reason those instances take a while to start is perhaps because there's some standard policies within the organization. And as I say, financial services, very well regulated, they have all sorts of sensible protections around these instances. So there could be additional security agents that need to be deployed and started up. There could be binaries need to be downloaded at runtime to enable those calculations to go ahead. Perhaps some of that data needs to get copied directly onto the instance before it can start being effective. So what we do with customers is spend a lot of time trying to make sure we understand that startup process and where is the time being spent. And then we look at things like, well, what can we do to parallelize some of those things? What can we do to perhaps for some of the data sources, put them into a shared store so that you don't have to copy them onto every instance? And in some cases, we work with some of our security specialists and some of our compliance specialists to say, you know, these agents that you're installing, you know, perhaps make sense for an instance that's going to hang around for a month, but for an instance that's going to exist for 3 hours, do you really need, you know, all of your security and sort of inventory management tools, for example, for an instance that's pretty ephemeral?
Yeah, not to mention the licensing cost of having it there as well.
Absolutely.
And you touched on scheduling and the fact that it's kind of different in this world. And, you know, one of the beautiful parts about your role, Alex, is you get to speak to lots of customers. And in my experience, customers tell you what they need and also what they don't need. And I take it from some of that feedback, you've created something called HGC Grid. And so I'm interested in what that is all about.
Absolutely. Yeah. So HGC Grid was created a couple of years back. I can't take any credit for the code. I have some very capable colleagues who put this together. But the idea of HGC Grid was to work as a blueprint, really to demonstrate this concept actually of a much simpler scheduler working in the cloud and relying much more on orchestration in AWS to make sure you can manage a very high throughput. HTC stands for high throughput computing. Really what we wanted to understand is, could we build a very high throughput scheduler that's very simple and as much as possible based on standard AWS building blocks? And so what we've got is HTC, which is a very pluggable system, which enables you to run up to, I think we've benchmarked up to 30,000 tasks a second. Oh. And it's based on SQS as the primary channel.
So I mentioned queues earlier. The old reliable.
Old reliable,
that's
absolutely.
The job.
which has the benefit of being, you know, it's a managed service, it's multi-AZ, and it offers that very high throughput. And there's a few other sort of parts of the control plane. We use a DynamoDB to kind of track the life cycle of tasks to make sure we don't drop anything. But fundamentally, it's a really simple architecture. And with that simplicity comes pluggability. So what we designed it to do is enable you to plug in a data plane. So I mentioned some of the data sources that are required for those calculations. Your data plane might be as simple as S3. You might put some of your binaries into S3. That might scale perfectly fine as a shared file system. Or perhaps you want to use FSx for Lustre. Again, that's entirely possible. And then on the compute side of things, we're kind of thinking ahead to, yeah, how do we give customers a glide path to a potential future? And so the pluggable control plane enables you to use EC2. If that's your sort of standard bread and butter today, you can use EC2. But some customers are leaning towards containers. So if you want to use ECS, EKS, that will work too. And then lastly, it also allows customers to use Lambda. And we have this kind of potential vision of potentially in the future being able to run some of these calculations directly on a service that is or looks like Lambda and kind of combines that kind of scheduling and orchestration in a single service.
I can imagine that if it's interesting as Lambda has grown in its sort of capacity from a CPU memory and a storage perspective over time, it sort of opened itself up to more workloads. You know, if you've got something that runs in less than 15 minutes and can run with the capacity there, it's kind of an appealing approach, isn't it, to have an army of Lambdas out there doing your calculations.
Absolutely. It takes away a lot of that heavy lifting. And a lot of these calculations are really short. So, you know, we spoke about Spot earlier. You know, a lot of the calculations our customers are running are in the order of a few seconds up to a handful of minutes. And so that's why they're perfect. Great for Spot, but you can see how that then maps over to Lambda.
Totally, because you're just eliminating all the startup time. What do you see? You talked about HTC Grid evolving. What do you see it doing in the future?
Well, HTC Grid, as I say, is not an AWS service, right? So you won't find it in the console, but really its intention is to act as a blueprint for customers. And so we have some customers using it as a foundation for their own system. So they said, hey, we're going to build our own thing. But because HTC Grid exists and we know the performance characteristics of it, it gives us a good foundation on top of which we can build some quality of life features, or perhaps we can modify it for our own needs. But with that in mind, we've actually released HTC Grid to the Financial Services Open Source Foundation, or FinOS. And so we're a new member of that group, and this is our first submission. And so what we're hoping is that because customers build cool new things and quality of life features and new capabilities, that they get contributed back to the community so that we can really just see, you know, where does the industry take this thing?
Now, it's always interesting to see what customers do when they get their hands on it, because some of them want different storage platforms, some of them want different capabilities. It depends. But speaking of customers, Alex, tell us a story. Tell us a story about a customer you've worked with, some of the things they experienced, just to give us, I guess, some visceral experience of what it's like to work in this sector.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, you know, one of the joys of my role is I get to kind of see this problem across the industry, and there's always different nuances and different areas of focus for different customers. Most recently, we were working with a customer looking to move to a more cloud-native approach and to reduce their on-premises capacity to avoid a hardware refresh. And this is really common. You know, as I mentioned earlier, customers with 1,000 machines sitting in a data center, sooner or later, they reach end of life, and to replace 1,000 machines all in one go is a lot of CapEx. And so that can be a real impetus for customers to come talk to us. They'd actually built their own scheduled architecture, funnily enough, based on a simple set of queues. So again, you know, no monopolies on good ideas, right? That these architectures are pretty common. And they're using EKS to orchestrate the capacity, so scaling containers up and down, and effectively greedily pulling off a queue. They process those tasks, and then they push the results back into another queue. Now, as I mentioned, one of the challenges that's fairly common here is that data distribution. So you've got kind of transient data related to a particular task, so or a particular scenario, and you've got market environment data, which is more shared data. Things like historic data, historic market data, and the holiday calendars or the static data, which needs to be available to all of those pods. And then the last problem is the analytics code itself. And we haven't touched on this yet, but this is actually another kind of common problem, which is all of these analytics that run through these scenarios are quite proprietary code to our customers. It's part of their secret sauce. Absolutely. And it's been developed over, in some cases, kind of decades, right? There's a lot of it. There's a lot of historic expertise in there. And so it can be quite large.
Let me guess, Alex, this code is well documented, easy to read, and developed in modern software languages and frameworks.
You would love to think so, yeah. So what we're trying to do is kind of work with customers to figure out, you know, what's the best mix to solving these problems? And I guess one of the beauties of AWS is there's no one solution to everything. And so what we ended up doing is working with them to find the optimal combination of Amazon S3, actually using MountPoint because they wanted kind of POSIX interactivity with S3.
Interesting. Yeah.
FSx Lustre for the kind of highly low latency stuff, so the more transient data, you know, where they need that very high performance. So FSx for Lustre is very helpful there. So they're using EBS or instant stores to store some of that data locally. And then they're using EFS for some of the holiday calendars, you know, the reusable data.
Yeah, the sort of long-term. And so that's, I think, a really interesting thing there that you've talked about, you know, four different kinds of storage solution. And to the untrained eye, you may say, well, now you've got four things to worry about. But firstly, you don't have to worry about them because you're not managing them. But they all do very different things. And you know, you touched on instance store, and I think we forget about instance storage sometimes when we're talking about EC2. But you know, most EC2 instances have some blazing fast NVMe type storage available to it on the instance type. And if you're doing local calculations that do require, you know, temporary files and push in, push out of data in an intermediate result perspective, your choice there can affect your performance very significantly. So being able to tweak all these things to make it blazingly fast is actually quite important.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's that tweaking that's important. And as I say, a lot of customers don't have specific requirements on that storage. So the way we were pitching the instance store is, if you're using Spot and you happen to select an instance that has an instance store, use it. It's all gravy, right? You've got it, you may as well have that extra performance. And where there are calculations that specifically benefit from that, obviously, then you can set the configuration for that pool of compute to say, hey, I only want instances with instance store. But yeah, where you can have that kind of mix and be able to bring in the optimal solution is really powerful, and it gives you a lot of optionality in the way you architect these things.
And so what happened? You went through this process, you've re-architected. What did it look like post the work?
Well, this is still ongoing, so time will tell. But I think what we're doing at the moment is running some simulations. So we've built a test lab and we're demonstrating to customers, you know, or the customer, just how this thing will work and how this thing will perform. One of the challenges customers have in financial services is there's quite a lot of controls around the AWS services that they can use, right? So if they want to onboard Lustre, for example, they have to go through a security process. And so a big part of what my team does is demonstrate capabilities before they go down that road, because if they have to put a lot of effort into getting a service onboarded, we want to make sure they're going to be successful. And so right now where we are with this customer is at the stage of demonstrating those capabilities so that they can go forward with confidence.
And that's the nice thing is, you know, our services are covered by so many certifications and accreditations, et cetera. It actually makes it easier in the long term to continue to onboard services that meet the requirements of different regulators, et cetera. But you do typically initially, particularly with newer customers, work through that process of saying, hey, let me introduce you to this thing called AWS Artifact, and let me show you how you can find things, and here's all our reports and we've already done it. No, you will not be inspecting the data centers. You know, it doesn't work that way. It's a different model.
Customers rarely run to a service they can't use, but they have to go through the process and they have to prioritize which services they're going to onboard next. And so we can really help them make that decision and prioritize and then go through the process and then onboard that service and be successful.
From a listener perspective, has this customer, you know, the folks working on this project, have they gone through a process of having to relearn some of the technology landscape? Were they cloud savvy originally, or have they, what's their journey been like?
So I think, you know, this customer's been using, you know, the cloud for a while. Really, they deployed this system, this in-house grid scheduler on-prem first. And so they built it out using some standard off-the-shelf open source components, as well as container architecture using Kubernetes. And that actually translated pretty well into AWS, you know, in the first iteration. But you know, as we started at this conversation, right, everything works well, you know, on your desk at a small scale. But once you start really pushing the boundaries of scale, that's where you start finding those edge cases. And that's where myself and my team really, I think, add value is just helping customers through those pain points as they start scaling up and finding the sharp edges as you go up. Because we've got a lot of experience working with customers solving, you know, this exact problem, you know, generally speaking, we can guide them in the right direction.
Yeah, finding the happy path is always important. Alex, where can folks go and learn more?
What I recommend is have a look at the AWS Financial Services Industries pages. You can find those on the AWS website. Also, check out Finos and the HTC Grid projects. We're very pleased with it and would love to hear any feedback or ideas on that. And if you're after me, I'm on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing with us a bit of insight into this world.
Thanks, Simon.
And we do love to get your feedback. AWS podcast at amazon.com is the place to do it. And until next time, keep on building.